Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas!
You're listening to Christmas Hamper on FUBAR Radio.
Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
My very special guest today, Mr. Stephen Merchant. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Dan.
How you doing?
I'm all right.
Good.
My question is, how are you?
Is that the one question you have for this?
That's
whole...
it.
Yeah, I'm okay. Yeah, we're here in Los Angeles. You had your own show on HBO a couple
right.
of years ago. Did you have a team of people?
Small team. Yeah,
a small team.
Small team in the sense that it was 5 or 6 people as opposed to 12.
Yeah.
Or whatever you might find on a big network show. Great working with a team like that.
Yeah.
Really exciting, and you just feel like you're in a room with very smart people, and you throw up an idea, and it kind of, you know, pinballs around the room and develops, and or like a snowball, a lot of ball metaphors here, like it snowballs, you know, and it kind of builds, and that I really found exciting.
Was it weird at first, though, having written either solely or with Ricky before,
right,
to suddenly like sort of throw an idea that like it's your show and someone might go, I'm not sure about that, Steve, what about this? And
or but you know what it's like as a writer, I think that's the process. There's no ego for me when I'm writing. Like, it doesn't, I don't feel defensive about ideas,
yeah.
Or kind of embarrassed if someone doesn't like it, or and it's not a question of sort of pulling rank,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that's exciting to me, the kind of the dialectic, if you will,
okay.
of the writing room, you know, all these different views kind of clashing together. I think what is important is that you remain very sort of firm in what the tone of the show is going to be, because otherwise it can start to get disparate, like all these different ideas, and
yeah.
it's, and it's quite easy to spend hours just discussing things and never nailing anything down.
So your job is to be more like making sure the vision is coming, you know.
I'm very much the Donald Trump of the equation,
okay.
you know.
Okay. Wow.
I've had some success.
Yeah.
I'm calling the shots. I'm shooting from the hip.
You have a no Mexican policy on your staff.
I have a no Mexican policy
on your writing.
I've built a large wall. Everything is tremendous.
Yeah.
It's going to be a tremendous show. We're full of tremendous talent.
You're going to make HBO great again.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I'm the sort of ringleader, but, you know, I'm surrounded, I'm sure as Trump is, by the best brains in the business.
I love that this interview is now going to be a comparison between Trump's career and yours.
Sure. Yeah.
You need to get yourself a really tall building in New York.
Michael Payne and Marcel Somerville on FUBAR Radio.
Our third and final guest, who is a legend in himself. He goes by the name George the Poet, man.
Yes, sir.
It's been a long time coming, man. You know how long I've wanted you to pass through this show? It's mad.
Yeah, man. Everything in its time.
But you've been busy, boy.
Yeah.
You've been genuinely doing mad things.
Yeah, it's been a colourful journey still.
Yeah, because when I first met you, we worked together on an EP called Lucky Strike.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. Steel Bangles produced the whole thing. You came through, and I remember you laced the whole... It was all prologues for the songs that I was doing, and you laced the whole thing in one day, one sort of session.
Oh, yeah.
And then I just thought, this guy is just insanely talented, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you've collaborated with, like, Wretch 32, Krept and Conan...
True.
Chase and Status, mm-hmm. obviously.
That one's up.
And we actually had Rosala in, and she really did give that song her stamp of approval. You know?
Blessings.
So it feels good.
Yeah,
it must feel good, right? And so then anyway, like I said, you know, in just your spoken word career, you've done some brilliant things. But now you're an award-winning podcast host.
Multi-award-winning.
Award-winning doesn't even do it justice. I'm going to read them out. This is the closest I'm ever going to get to presenting This Is Your Life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I am Michael Aspel right now. Not Michael Payne. Michael Bumbleclaw Aspel. So you won Gold, the Audio Boom Podcast of the Year. Best Arts and Culture. Best Fiction, Best New Podcast, Smartest Podcast, and then Silver, Acast Moment of the Year, and Silver for Best Current
Affairs. And that was at the same award ceremony for the British Podcast Awards, at the same one.
Yeah, I think that deserves a round of applause in itself.
Thank you very much.
Did you have these as goals when you first started the podcast?
No, I didn't know that there were podcast awards.
Mm.
Podcasting obviously has exploded pretty much exponentially.
Yeah.
In recent times. But I was just doing what I thought was exciting.
Yeah.
What felt like a bit of a risk. Like, how is this? How are people really going to take to this? Because this is hella unfiltered.
Mm.
But I guess that's the reward on the opposite side of that mountain.
Yeah, yeah. So you won an award for Acast Moment of the Year. Can you tell us what moment that was? Or are they talking about the podcast, like, generally as a moment?
Nah, I think in our application we submitted a part of the podcast that's from an episode about Grenfell Tower.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's not really about the tower, but it's about the life of someone. Fictional character.
Right.
But in the lead up to the tragedy. And that took me, it took me about 2 weeks to write.
Mm.
It's a piece of drama, but I didn't say a word about Grenfell for a year.
Mm.
So I guess it took me a year to write, because I see Grenfell from my window, innit? So I was just shell shocked.
Yeah, of course.
For time. And then I went on a trip to Canada. My mind was opened. I saw some amazing things. Shouts out to C2 Montreal. But just before I took off, like, everything just clicked. I was like, I got to make that story. And I quickly voice note. I sent Benbrick, the producer, I sent him an 8-minute voice note, got on a plane, and then within weeks, that thing was done. So that's the one that...
they picked as the specific moment that they awarded you for.
Yeah.
Is that your highlight? Is that a personal highlight? What's your favourite moment from the... it's like a 9-part series, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's your favourite moment?
What's your favourite song? Do you have a favourite song of yours?
At the moment, I'd have to say, I don't know. I think it's easier for me right now to pinpoint my favourite film, but my favourite song, because I don't think I can.
No, my guy, see, I was all saying of yours.
Yeah, of your song.
Oh, of mine.
Your own track. Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Okay, cool. Favourite song right now is called Cut From A Different Cloth, and I'm listening to it a lot, and you'll probably do this a lot, and you'll probably do this a lot, Marcel. Even you, Natalie, with your
secret
rap career.
I do listen to my own tracks quite a lot. I do.
Right. So, you listen to something that you're just about to release. I don't know if, like I said, I don't know if you guys...
Yeah, just to get a vibe. Just to make sure.
Just make sure it's still slapped. You know what I mean? Yeah. So right now, that is the track that I haven't got bored of yet, so I know it's a vibe.
Well, wouldn't that make sense for it to be, if you are releasing new music, to be the song that you love the most of your own? If you're going to release it, wouldn't that make sense for that to be the track that you love the most?
Right.
Because you're about to put it out.
Exactly.
So I've got a theory. I might as well throw this out earlier.
Please.
I feel like there's a formula for everything. Couple months ago, I caught up my little brother. He just needed a bit of space to do revision. I said, yeah, use my yard. And I came back, and he was revising for his A-levels maths, and he's talking to me about this subject. I was like, if you can break this down to me, a complete layperson in this field, then your revision's going well.
Yeah.
And he basically explained that what he was revising, differentiation, is the study of how, of just change, representing change graphically, how something changes in relation to something else.
Okay.
And the way he brought down the formulas, I was like, yo, there's formulas in life. So ever since then, I just see formulas for certain things.
Mm.
And I think what you lot just touched on is one of those kind of formulas. If you know that as an artist, you're going to be putting out work that is most exciting to you at that given moment, and you know that you're going to change as a person, then we can actually calculate the formula of what your output's going to be. We know that it's going to take your present moment, your vibes, whatever music you're listening to, whatever book you might be reading, add all of that up, and it's going to output exactly your projection of yourself in all of that.
Yeah,
that's
true.
A formula.
Yeah.
You get me?
That's a good fucking point.
Yeah. Mm.
That is a really good point.
I don't know why I thought I need to break that down to you, but
no, I'm glad you did, actually, because
I
think
I've
thought about that kind of concept before, but I've never been able to kind of put it into those words, you know?
No, because it's true. It's inherent in existence. It's truth. You get me? Like, you might catch on to it in bits, like, that's a clue about how the universe works. But remember, it actually works regardless of whether or not you understand it.
This is true. Irrespective of us, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you are absolutely right. Ian Boltzmann on Free Bar Radio.
Story. What a perfect run-in that was to speak with Rob Schneider on the telephone.
Yeah, hi.
Hello,
how are
sir?
You?
I'm all right, man. How are you?
I'm good. I couldn't help but notice you're swearing a little bit, so I guess that's okay on here.
Yeah, go for it. What ones do you want to do? What swears would you like to do?
No. I'm not for just egregious vulgarity.
No.
So I'm not averse to it.
I agree. Say you were doing an interview on a radio station that didn't permit swearing. So in the UK, you'd be regulated by Ofcom, which is a regulatory body that would fine you for swearing. But this station isn't Ofcom regulated, so we don't fall under the remit of Ofcom.
Okay.
So if you were doing an interview with a station that was Ofcom regulated and you came off that interview and were like, do you know what, I wish I could have just called them whatever, what's the most likely thing you would have wanted to call me?
I don't don't even really know you that yet, Ian. I figure
I can give you some words. Rob, I can help you. I can help you with some words to quote him.
The first time I ever heard the C word, by the way, spoken out loud. I mean, I knew that it existed, but literally my whole childhood, up till I was 13, it had never been uttered by any adult or any child in the playground. And then when I was 13, my first trip to London, England, I got on a bus, and like within 45 seconds of being in the country, I had heard the word about 90 times.
Yeah.
It's over to the most minor thing, though. Somebody on the double-decker bus had taken somebody else's seat. And the next thing you know, I said, you fucking cunt. You bloody cunt. You know, you are, you fucking cunt.
Yeah.
Like, I was so aghast.
But to me,
this seems... To me, it was such an unnecessary, egregious use of the most vulgar word in the English language that I had never heard, and all of a sudden I was about to hear it 80 times between one bus stop. I just thought, my God, what kind of country is this?
I put it to you, Rob, though, that you still use that, like you drew on that from your past as a sort of a titillating way for you to be allowed to do it on the radio just now.
I mean, I didn't think about that.
When you were telling that story, you couldn't wait to get to the bit. you were giddy.
It's not fair that you know my mind and how, you know, comedians work.
Yeah.
You're obviously a comedian yourself.
Yeah, you were proper. Listen,
you're the Oz. Don't pull back the veil. Let your audience enjoy themselves.
All right, well, all I'll say to you then, from behind the comedy curtain is, you were so excited it slightly threw your timing off on the run-up. Because you were trying to get to it quicker.
So it's a pain in the ass talking to comedians because they know the wheels when they're working.
Do you know what's worse about me?
What's that?
I'm an ex-comedian. So I've stopped doing it. So now I've got literally fucking nothing to lose. I no longer need to play by the rules on any level. I don't need to, because I'm not like looking for careerist opportunities. I'm not like going, oh, well, if I say this, then I'm out of that club. It's like, fuck it, I'm happily out of every club. So I'm the most
Here's the thing. You're
dangerous
you're recovering.
Yeah.
You're recovering. You're never really an ex.
That's true. That's true. You retain the comedic sensibilities. So do you know what? And please don't take this as... rather, you can take it how you want to take
it. Here it comes.
No, take it.
There's never anything good with that premise.
No, take it however you want
never
to
get
take
like,
it.
Don't take this the wrong way, but I'm a huge fan. Yeah. Never comes there.
Yeah, but you're
like, hey, don't take this the wrong way, but I think you're a pile of shit. Never anything good. Don't take this the wrong way, but I think you have an incredible mind. It's never like, don't take this the wrong way, but oh my God, your wife's gorgeous.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
There's never anything like that.
Well, all right. Well,
what do you got?
All I was going to say was, I didn't know you did stand-up.
Oh.
That was all. I actually wasn't aware of it.
Okay, I was expecting some vulgarity.
Exactly. Oh, and you're a cunt. No, I didn't. I actually didn't know you did stand-up. I genuinely didn't.
Well, I was avoiding it for a long time because you have to really, you know, Ian, how hard it is.
Yeah.
You have to do it all the time. You can't just get up there and fake it. I mean, Jerry Seinfeld says, hey, I don't care how famous you are. The audience gives you 1 minute, maybe two.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And then you have to be funny.
Yeah.
You can't fake it.
I spoke to... Do you know Harry Hill? Is he UK? Harry Hill. Not Howie Hill.
Oh, yeah.
Harry Hill. And Al Murray as well, who are huge comics in the UK. And whenever I spoke to either of them... That's not a name drop, but whenever I spoke to either of those two, they worked together as well, you know, a fair bit over the years. And they both maintain you've got 5 minutes grace with fame. So if you're famous...
I think that's being generous. If you're an American guy going over there, I think you get 2.5 because after a while, the audience... Like, my daughter, who's a pop star, she was playing in, like, Shrewsbury, like, some music festival. And I went through Shrewsbury when I was a young man, and there was, like, a 98% unemployment back then in, like, the early 80s. And it was just not a happy place to be, you know. And I just remember, you know, as any place would be with that high unemployment. And I just remember my daughter called me with tears in her eyes. She says, I was between songs. My daughter's Elle King.
Okay.
And I was between songs and I was tuning my guitar, and some guy in the front yelled out, get on with it! I think you guys, it's your language, we're bastardizing it, so you can do what you want with it.
Do you know what, man? You're hitting on another reason that I packed in stand-up, is that I couldn't be arsed with that level of rudeness anymore. Like, I really couldn't.
Well, you know, I mean, American jazz, which was an American invention of taking traditional kind of music and just be more, not necessarily a, but just...
kind of going off theme and enjoying that being more off than on in an improvisational form. It's the same thing with stand-up comedy, which is, again, started out as an American art form, which we're really kind of, I guess you can go back to Mark Twain or whatever. It is something that you have to deal with. And, like, what you don't want to do is it's not like a yelling match. You know, and some people who come to your show or think, well, I'll just yell one in there too. But it's like, you know, George Carlin. I used to go see George, you know, the great comedian, the American comedian, Carlin. He'd be backstage, and he'd have these rows and rows and rows of these 3x5 cards. And he says, hey, now I'm not just performing jokes. I'm performing a written word. I've written this out. It's a performance. And so sometimes people can throw that performance off by jumping in. I mean, comedy's a very, as you know, it's a fragile thing. It's like cutting a diamond.
Yeah.
Somebody yells out at the wrong place, or if your timing is off, or if you flip a little word here or there, then it just doesn't work. It's like Mark Twain, the great American writer, who's really probably should be credited as the first stand-up comedian. He used to travel around the world, take notes. And before people could travel around the world, like in the early 20th century, he would come around, perform at, like, union halls, when there was union halls, and charge like a buck, and then he would just regale people with these stories.
Yeah.
But he said, explaining a joke is like dissecting a frog. All the parts are still there, but it just doesn't jump.
Yeah, nice. That's perfect. Yeah, absolutely true.
Harriet Rose on FUBAR Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, FUBAR Radio, I'm joined by Albert Hammond Jr. in the studio right now. Albert, how's it going?
It's great. We're in a studio. It's warm. It's pretty good.
Well, outside it's not so warm. You've joined us in blizzard temperatures in the UK. Sorry about that.
Yes. No, it's okay. It's all coming from this Russian air.
Oh, do you know things about
Siberian air? I mean, I don't know things. TV happened to be on. I know things.
You know stuff.
I know stuff about
weather.
You
know one whole more thing than me, because I didn't know that, so.
Well, it's just the TV was on, and they were like, oh, the Atlantic swells are being stuck up. Not stuck up, like
stuck up
very snobby.
Something.
I'm not going down to London. No, and then the air was coming across, which means, like, Germany, France, where I'm going next, is even colder.
Have you ever thought about a career in meteorology? Because your voice is incredible for reading the weather. Just then, I was completely enthralled by it.
That's so funny. I'm glad. No, but I feel like that's definitely a job that you could do when you're older. I would love to do that.
Yeah, just, like, next career
path. I'd love to just sit there and talk about things.
Is there any sort of rituals that you do before gigs that get you G'd up and ready, so even if you are tired, that you can bring your A game?
Oh, no matter what, you can be as tired as you want, you'll always get up before you have to go.
Yeah, but like, do you like practice yoga or do some, like, eat some hummus? I've heard lots of different pre-game rituals.
Eating is terrible. I like to play on an empty stomach. You got to be hungry almost to play. Well, if you're full, it's just burping and just like, it's like, oh, you know, I don't want to play. You know, you got to be light on your toes. Yoga is fun. I don't do it before a show, but, you know, I haven't. Maybe if I was, when I start playing arenas, I will gladly do yoga before a show. I always wanted to come out. My goal is to be playing big enough venues, huge venues, so I can bring a treadmill and I can get sweaty before I go on stage, so I can walk out sweating, because I like. Mike Tyson used to walk out before a fight sweating. I thought that was so cool. Everyone would just come out and look like they were, like, not ready. And he would just come out like, I just beat up two people and now I'm going to kick your ass.
So you want it to look like you've already done three gigs.
I'm just like, oh, man, this guy is ready to go. You know?
He's going to sing his ass off.
I like that. I enjoy exhausting myself for singing for, you know, it's the entertainment that I like to do. It's always enjoyable. It's never a bad tired. It's always like a very fulfilling tired.
That's the best way to be, though, having a fulfilling tiredness.
Yeah, for sure. I'm very lucky, even in its intensity, like this week, I'm still very lucky.
Is there anything that you feel like the UK brings to when you perform live that is different to other countries? Is there anything you sort of look forward to when you come down here?
To be completely honest, every place, every time you go, can change. And people always say, like, oh, that one. And certain ones, are notorious because maybe they have a better batting average. But we just played Brixton, opening for friends, and I felt like it was my show the way the crowd was cheering. It was amazing, and people were always like, oh, you go to London, it's like, you know, it's dead. It was anything but dead. It felt deafening. I think that's part of the fun, is the unknown. Also, your role in having to bring it to them or take it out of them if they're not – willing to give it up. You know, that's like a, that's part of the, where's this show going to take me? Where am I going to have to push? Where am I going to break? And then realize I have to keep going. That's always interesting to me.
Must be an exciting feeling every time.
That's why your nerves never go away, because they change into something where maybe when you first start out, you're like worried about crazy things that wouldn't happen. And now your worry isn't so much a worry, but how quickly I can adapt to the situation. And that just keeps you on your toes.
Access all areas on FUBAR Radio.
Ricky Garnaccio.
Hello,
Ricky.
What's going on, Ricky?
Hey, baby girl.
Hey, baby. Have I said your surname correct? I've tried.
Garnaccio.
Okay.
I do this every time.
I'll just call you Ricky.
Every year.
I'm sorry. Because obviously we loved you on Geordie Shore. You were there from 2012, 2013. Do you miss not doing it?
No, it was good, but I mean, we all went back to the big birthday battle a few years back. I mean, I came back from Australia for it, and it was just, when you've got that many people in the show, we're trying to film, there's 16 of us, and wow, it wasn't the same as when I first went in that series two,
right.
And we're just all just going out, we're just going crazy and stuff, but I don't know, man. It was good. Obviously, it's given us the platform to do everything that I'm doing now and stuff. But yeah, I mean, those days are going out every single night.
It's a long time ago now.
Drinking twice a day, man. Having two hangovers a day. Yeah.
Come on, I'll do that as well. My PAs. Can't talk too much about it.
You boys and your PAs.
Hey, I'm 32 now, Jack.
All right, okay then. There we go.
He's calming down. But I have to say, Ricky, I loved you when you did Celebrity Big Brother. I mean, that must have been one hell of an experience for you.
I don't want to sound a bit negative towards every TV show,
but you're glad it's over.
It was boring.
Really?
I was 27 when I went in there, and obviously when you go in there, you think, oh, you're going to be partying, you're going to be drinking, or doing whatever, really. But you've got three rooms to go between, and then they weren't giving us, I think because Charlotte did the series before me, I think they cut back with Ofcom with giving them drink. So when I went in, we were getting nothing between 14 of us. So I was like, you put a 27-year-old party boy in a house with no tools.
Yeah.
give me something to do.
You were getting restless.
Yeah.
So what's going on? Because, listen, on the 1st of May, it's my birthday was on the 2nd of May. Thanks for the present, Ricky. But on the 1st of May, you wrote a little tweet saying, when's Single Appreciation Day? So what's going on? Are you single? What's going on with the love life?
Yeah, of course I'm single. I mean, I'm going back to Australia at the end of this year. I'm obviously looking for property over there. I'm buying. I'm moving over there for good. Can I take this weather anymore? So, yeah, I've been single for 3 years. But, I mean, Jack has said, okay, this, when you travel around doing PAs and you travel in different countries and stuff like that, it's hard to settle down with a bird, especially being the public eye.
Yeah, you can't.
It's just hard to find someone you're generally right. I'm picky, Liz. Yeah. I'm really, really picky.
Oh, I'm so picky. But, I mean, do you find that you want to have, if you did have a girlfriend, it would be someone famous? Or would you rather not have that again? Because you've got so much attention with all the press and stuff. Or is it...
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that relationship, I mean, it's still obviously... ongoing with people talking about it and people wanting views on it and so all that and all that bollocks kind of thing. But I mean, it's just part and parcel of being the public guy. Everyone wants to know what you're doing, who you're with, and how you're doing this. Everything's magnified. Obviously, when it comes to a public relationship with someone else in the public eye, it's kind of like if it does go west, then I mean, your side wants to be said, and then their side wants to be said. And that's the only issue with it,
right?
Yeah, but then you've got obviously people that aren't the public eye, and I mean, everyone wants to be famous these days.
Now, what do you think? I've heard Adam Collard might be going into the Geordie Shore house. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I saw something yesterday. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, with Geordie Shore now, I mean, the whole cast really sort of changed, Liz. I mean,
yeah.
I'm just giving my honest opinion as well. I mean, it's not really Geordie Shore anymore when they go out and get tans and when they go to the gym, and it was kind of, it was based on Jersey Shore, and that's how we got our TV show off the back of them, but... I mean, the whole kind of...
It's changed, hasn't
thing,
it?
The thing with it now, it's kind of like the prefer in-house relationships. You don't see the lads going out anymore and really pulling birds and stuff. But it's not really...
It's staged.
I don't look at it as Geordie Shore, really. And even, I mean, it's what I was saying. If you get all the... I mean, with Jersey Shore, they've just filmed another series with all of them back together. I mean, you've got Paulie D, who's 30. Yeah, you've got the situation, who's now in prison, but he's 40.
So now I am joined by LGBT plus icon and living legend, Armistead Maupin. I hear you're really excited about being on FUBAR because you're allowed to swear and say whatever you like.
I don't have to worry about it. I usually swear in all sorts of places and they look horrified. But I think we must use all words in the language.
Absolutely.
When we want to tell a story.
So let's talk a little bit about Tales of the City. Now, this is a series that so many people have recommended to me. I must confess, I've not actually read it yet. But one of my very best friends gave me a copy for my birthday. So I'm very excited to tear into it. Yeah, that's a start.
It's important that the young be indoctrinated. And I'm happy that someone's working it on you.
I feel like, as well, Tales of the City is something that is, you know, well-loved by young generations and the older generations. You know, it's something that spans absolutely everybody. And it was written across several decades as well.
It's been going on for 43 years now. And I've always tried to update it with younger characters. Yeah. We had to bring in some writers this time around because I can't keep up with everything. But we have a really rich show that speaks to everyone's experience. There's a lot of intergenerational stuff in Tales of the City that's dear to my heart because when I was first coming out 40 years ago, I had people older, even older gay people. Christopher Isherwood, the writer who created the Berlin stories and therefore Cabaret, who invented Liza Minnelli, for heaven's sake, was all constantly throwing parties where there were all ages of queers. And we got to tell our stories to each other. And it sort of validated everything. You could see where they had been and where you were going. But we have moments in Tales where generations share their experience, a particularly powerful one between Michael Tolliver and his 30 years younger lover, husband. Now, they're not married yet. I want them to be married. Where they talk about the fact that Michael doesn't share his experiences with AIDS. He was so traumatized by this, as many of us were at that time when your friends were all dropping dead. It was like a horror show.
Yeah.
And you bury it. You don't talk about it. And it becomes a moment where they're sharing to the degree that they can become closer as two men.
I feel like the LGBT plus community in particular is this place where we do have this kind of crossing generations that you don't see anywhere else. You know, you can walk into a gay bar even now and there'll be an 18-year-old and an 80-year-old.
That's the joy of it.
Stories.
That's the joy of it. I always say it's like being in the Navy. You can come to a strange town, but you recognize the uniform and there's fellowship.
Yeah, absolutely.
Instant fellowship. And we need to not let go of that. Real easy to do when you've got the internet and you can find exactly what you wanted. Online.
Yeah, absolutely.
I said the other day, probably in a place I shouldn't have said it, that I'm not going to be one of those old queens that complains about you young people today with your grinder. You got it so easy. In my day, we had to walk 20 miles through the snow just to suck a cock.
Wow. But it's true, you know. It is true.
Well, it's sort of true.
But, you know, you can use grinder today. Everyone can use it.
As a matter of fact, it wasn't grinder, but I met my husband on a website called Daddy Hunt.
Oh, wow.
I didn't meet him on the website. I was walking down the street and saw him. Beautiful man that he still is today after 15 years, and recognized him from Daddy Hunt.
Oh, wow. Now that is something.
And so I knew he liked men over 45.
Yeah.
And as I said at the time, I was overqualified for that position. That grew out of the use of the internet.
I think that really is modern day romance, isn't it?
It really is. Everybody.
Quite touching.
Everybody straight and gay meets their true love online eventually after some serious disasters.
Joey Page on FUBAR Radio.
I'm now very excited to be in the hallowed dressing room of the wonderful, amazing Mr. Gary Newman. How you doing?
I'm doing really well, thank you. Not sure about hallowed, though.
Well, you've got the nicest sofa out of all the dressing rooms. You've got the best chairs.
Brilliant.
There you go. Don't know if that was on your rider. Comfy little leather sofa.
No. Oh, God, no, nothing like that. No.
You're always, like, pushing the edge of it, and, like, it's a real credit to you that you've got your sound, but you're always, like, making it sound different, but you still know it's one of your records, do you know what I mean?
I think that the voice is sort of quite recognisable.
Yeah.
Which is a double-edged sword, really, because it's not a particularly good one, but it has a sound. So as soon as you can do what you like with the music, I think, and as soon as I start singing, then it will sound like me.
Yeah.
Which isn't necessarily a good thing, but it does give you a sound, you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people search their entire careers to find a sound that's
of course
that's
there,
an identity that's there. So I'm not grumbling. Wish I had a better voice. That's all.
Do you feel like, I don't want to make it sound old, but like legacy wise do you feel like sometimes you don't necessarily get the respect that I would say you deserve, in terms of, like, you see people recently David Bowie's last couple of records and Paul Weller being like quite good at changing up their sound and pushing the boundaries. And I feel like you do exactly the same and you don't get quite as much credit for that.
I don't know, actually. I was thinking that I do pretty well in terms of credit. I got an Ivor Novello Award in May for innovation in songwriting. I got one last year from Q, I think, for, again, innovation or influence, I think it was. There's a massive amount of people who do covers of my stuff or sample my stuff and say loads of really, really cool things. So I felt for a long time that I get a really generous amount of credit for what I've done. It's not as if I'm out there looking at every interview and seeing if anyone mentions my name, because I don't really care too much about that side of it at all. Again, I've got no issues with that at all. Totally comfortable with the recognition.
Long may it continue. Like, I'm a real big fan. One thing, if there's a sudden downturn, I've got a second line of work for you if you're interested in this.
Really?
Right? Yeah. Come up with a brainchild. And it's, I had to write it down because I won't remember. Basically, if you fancy ever going into sort of like doing weddings, a super group with you, Gary Oldman, one of the borrowers, and Duncan from Blue. Something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. How do you feel about that?
Oh, yeah.
We'll do that.
Oh, it's a brilliant idea.
There we go.
That's why you're where you are.
Yeah, exactly why I'm only where I am. Ian Bolton.
Hello, welcome to the show. We have Tiny Tampa going to be joining us on the Tap Alone. Hiya, Tiny, this is Ian here. I'm not particularly well up on rap, but I've always been a fan. And I watched Straight Outta Compton, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest with you, it's been a while since I'd sort of engaged with hip-hop or anything like that. For a while, my teens, was when DMC and Beastie Boys as well were sort of, you know, with the big well-known things in the UK, you know, then followed by Public Enemy and Andrew Ray and all that sort of thing. So, in terms of what you're aware of at that point, I still feel like in my former years, it was something that was quite important to me. But when I watched Straight Outta Compton the other week, I said to you, Nat, about me feeling like I didn't want to feel like I was appropriating something else. It felt like it wasn't for me, so I had no right to like it.
I mean, my engineer's from Ireland, and I've known him since I was 14. I'm 28 now. Whenever we get into heated discussions, he always says that there is sometimes a risk, him, from looking at it from an Irish perspective, that something can be made to feel like it's not for everyone. I mean, I get that. I definitely get that. I think, like I said, a lot of rap comes from a place of struggle, and I feel everybody has different struggles in different ways. But obviously, even if you look at like the way we do things on radio as people from Britain, everything is quite sartorial, everything is quite funny.
Yeah.
You know, we're always trying to kind of like take the mick out of each other in a clever way. That is almost like the style of the radio, right? That is a style that has been designed by somebody, and people have followed and followed and followed that format.
Yeah.
And I feel that when cultural appropriation comes into play is when a culture is not acknowledged. Like, for example, that's like me just taking, I guess, something from Indian culture or Asian culture, but not acknowledging that it's from there and then taking the mick out of it. That's when I think people can get angry. But in terms of you like liking something, in the same way I like Dolly Parton, I have no idea what country's Western music, where it came from.
Yeah.
I have no idea about her personal life or her background, but she has a good voice and she sang good songs, and it doesn't matter whether she's from Middle America or whether she's from Africa or whatever, I still like her. And I feel like that's what music is about. You know, music is for the soul, you know, not necessarily for the person. However, I do think, yes, you know, in this way that we do talk about music and talk about artists and do parodies and do skits and do gimmick kind of things in British culture, I definitely do feel like people could misinterpret that for cultural appropriation, definitely.
Yeah.
I guess Honey G, I didn't have a problem with Honey G because I thought it was funny, but I guess a lot of people I knew had a problem with the fact that she was being taken as a serious rapper, even though it was quite clear that it was like a side hobby. She had like a regular job, but then she would put on an outfit and then change her accent and make a few hand gestures. And then everyone would say, oh, she's transformed into this person. And then the way that the narrative was written, it's like she would do like a crib in her house, but then should say, oh, look at my kettle, and it'd be an actual kettle. Or,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, that for me is more of a form of cultural appropriation.
I think those programmes, though, generally speaking, do this. But I think Britain's Got Talent does the same thing, where I think it will take a genre of performance or a style of performance, or be it a comedian, be it a singer, be it a rapper, whatever it is. I think in order to work on those programmes, it's always going to be something very generic and very gimmicky. Or I've seen comics on Britain's Got Talent this year, both of whom, the two that I've seen, both of them I know as club comics who are fantastic, don't even want to look at what they did on Britain's Got Talent, because I know it won't be representative of what they actually do in their actual careers. So I guess that we can't take any performances having any credibility, for want of a better word, on a programme like that, because they, it will always be what they want you to do.
Some of those artists are the biggest selling artists in the world.
Absolutely.
I think in one respect you're right, but then in one respect you're kind of wrong as well, because the world has taken loads of those artists in. And it's reflected in their sales.
When I do gigs after people have got big momentarily from things like that, I mean, I've long laid the blame for the behaviour of audiences at Simon Cowell's door over the last 10 years. I really have, in terms of how they've manipulated how audiences look at a performer, no matter what they're doing. So I would certainly agree that it has gone through to the audiences. It has gone through to people where they...
And it is taken seriously.
But is it serious, or is it just that it's dumbed it down?
I don't know, man. I think everyone's got a different part to play in the sense of art, I guess. You own music, or the music industry, i.e. I'm the artist, you know, you guys are doing the interview, someone is putting together that show, and like you said, some artists, some which are incredibly, who are incredibly genuine, are going on there for exposure on a bigger platform, and some people see it as an opportunity to kind of get 15 minutes, and everybody's entitled to do what they want to do. But I mean, going back to what you were saying just about cultural appropriation, I think cultural appropriation comes from, and I'm very much British as well, but it's almost like our or Western culture's interpretation of other cultures and other art form within other cultures is where the issue of cultural appropriation comes from.
Okay.
And I think that, say that you watched Straight Out of Compton and it made you feel like it wasn't for you, I could understand why I say that, but I was almost just trying to kind of correct you and say that it is for you, it's for everyone, it's for anyone who can relate to it. The taboo or the stigma comes from when, I guess, people from a particular culture feel like their culture is being misrepresented or is being almost taken the mick out of in the very kind of like natural, deep-rooted way that we do in British media or radio. But if it's someone's culture, if it's someone's religion, that's when people might feel sensitive about it.
Yeah.
Access all areas on FUBAR Radio.
We've got another hot guest in the studio.
Sophie Herman, the German from Made in Chelsea.
Hello.
Looking amazing.
Thank you.
I just
so
want
do you.
Everything you're wearing.
Yeah, I know.
She looks good.
You guys, you've just been talking for 2 minutes and all you've done is talk fashion. I've just been sat here like a lemon.
But, Sophie, lovely to see you here at FUBA. What a show, Made in Chelsea. How did it all come about, Sophie? Tell us from the beginning.
From the beginning, oh, my God, we will have to scroll back to 2013
when
I used to be friends with Victoria Baker Harbour. She, at the time, wanted a female companion. Mark Francis only oozes that much.
Oh, I love him.
And, yeah, so we were friends. So I thought, why not? I had a fashion brand at the time, Sophie Herman London, and I thought it would be a great platform to promote that. And now here I am, 6 years later, without the brand and more Made in Chelsea. Oh, here he is, Miles. That's not what
Miles
I
meant. Miles enters the room.
Hi, Schweini.
Miles.
Always late. Schwein.
Hey, I love How's someone who to? Makes an entrance.
I'm so sorry, I'm late.
Someone got a new haircut, if that's why you're late.
I did get a haircut.
Did you get a haircut? Well, you're looking good.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
How
you.
Are you, Miles? You good?
I'm very well, very well. Very happy to be here. How are you guys?
Sharp as hell, isn't he? Look at this guy. Tattoos on his arms. Sexy son of a gun.
The tattoos.
I thought this was a pig, actually, and it's a lion.
It annoys me because everyone thinks this looks like a washing machine, a washer dryer.
That's true. It's a washer dryer and a Schwein. Yeah. Well done.
If you can't see it on the camera, this huge, grabby tumble dryer and washing machine combo on his forearm.
So Miles
he's very efficient at his washing. That's what we've learned so
Listen,
far.
Listen, he's late,
that's
but he looks
I'm looking
good.
For in a guy. Domesticated.
Domesticated. Fine.
So, Miles, how did you get into the show?
So, James, obviously, was on the show beforehand and we knew each other from South France, and I guess we got back in touch, and he was like, oh, I'm doing the show. Like, it'd be brilliant if you wanted to come on over with me. And I said, yeah, why not?
And since then,
yeah,
you've been dubbed the ladies' man of the show. Oh, so yeah. Are we saying that you're officially not a one girl at a time type of guy? Cat's got his tongue.
No, I think I love my serial data. No, I don't like to settle down straight away. So
you're
23.
Oh goodness, at 23.
But you were caught talking to James Taylor saying that you do like to play the field a bit and have a bit of fun, correct?
Yeah, yeah. If you're not putting a label or anything and you're direct with the person you're with or that you're maybe fooling around with or you're dating, I think, you know, you're allowed to do what you want.
Now, a certain cast member has made headlines recently, okay? Mm-hmm. About stripping down to her lingerie for miles as she attempts her with chocolate fondant. Tell us about this lady, this cast member. Come on, Mars, come clean on
Fuba. Okay, so the lady is my ex, Mava.
Great
yes.
name.
Yeah, French, Italian, very hot blood. Lovely, lovely, lovely girl. Yeah, she caught me by surprise. When that happened, I genuinely did not know what to do or how to react. She said, yeah, I'm going to get more Prosecco, and then said to me, close your eyes. I said, okay. I was like, okay, no,
me.
Surely
yeah, no, come
not.
Come on, at the back of your brain, you must have been like, this is going to be good, but there's a cameraman in the room.
Exactly.
So yeah. I don't really know how far she's going to go with this.
That is
eyes
exactly
open.
That. I was so shocked because in the back of my mind, I was like, yeah, she might, you know, undress whatever. But then I was like, no, there's cameras, like, she will never do it. And she can't undress. And I almost nearly looked into the camera. I was like, what? I really didn't expect it, but yeah, I mean...
There weren't moments like that on The Bachelor, but I can definitely tell you, when you're sort of stuck and lost for words and there's people in the room, you really don't know where to look.
Oh, God.
And then, obviously, there was only one thing that you probably could look at.
Yes, so, very true.
My God, so that must have blown your mind a bit.
I mean, I'm not lying, it was a fun night.
But you are renowned for hooking up with old girlfriends, correct? Or is that not correct?
They always end up coming back into my life. I don't
is
know
that,
why.
Can you bring that on yourself? Or yes. Do they just... Oh, yes. Just straight away. I was trying to get him out of it. Yeah. Gave him the option straight away.
Have you had
away.
A few drinks? Do you think, oh, you know what? I'm going to text him.
Are you, you going to text him?
Miles, literally, it takes two champagne and he's a whore. Sorry.
I hate to admit it, but you know me.
Oh,
you
do
know. I know. We've all gotten that booty call.
Sophie, have you had that booty call from Sam Thompson?
Me?
Yeah, is he
still the wrong Sophie, Dad?
Oh, wrong Sophie.
Never.
Come on, no.
No.
But I love the fact that the show is at stage because many people think that it is all kind of set up, the show, and the dramas and the rows and the love... Interest.
I think also it's like I would find it hard to act sad or act like, I mean, you know, when you see a lot on the show where you see people, you know, crying and all getting really irate and all of that, I mean, I just studied a bit of acting when I was in school, but I mean, I'm not that much of a good actor to, get
acting.
Tears down my face, like... It's hard.
I don't think anyone in the show is a great actor.
No.
Like, apart from Ollie Locke, he was amazing. Like, otherwise...
I love
Ollie. Really, yeah.
Ollie's amazing.
But I think because, you know, we get put into situations where we're all so tight-knitted together, then things are obviously, like, bound to explode way quicker than they would normally do.
I mean, are you conscious that the cameras are there, though? I mean, you know, but then are you not being your real self? Are you conscious of what you're going to say
forget.
Next?
Yeah.
I mean, in the beginning, I have to say, like, when I joined the show, the first, like, 1.5 years, I was, like, a bit weird and freaked out. And now, since I returned in 2016, I'm much more myself. You just get used to it, but... It takes some time.
Because I always think that you must be so subconscious of the cameras are right in your face or you're having a bit of a love scene or there's something quite intimate you're talking about. You've got cameramen and...
When you're on a scene or you're talking, you know, you can be talking sometimes for like hours and hours. You forget that there are like three main big cameras staring at you and recording everything because you're just talking, you're having normal chat. In the beginning, you know, when it's set up a little bit, you're like, okay, you're very aware of it. But then once you get into conversation with people, then it kind of... You forget.
Yeah,
I mean, it must be the same
with
Bachelor.
If you work with the crew on a daily basis as well, then, you know, they're kind of like friends and family as well, so you're much more
relaxed.
Relaxed, you know, opening up about stuff in front of them.
So what can we expect from the next... of the series.
Oh,
no,
God,
Miles, not more drama. I feel you spell trouble.
I know,
I
don't help myself, do I? I think you'll see a lot of emotions. I think there's a few friendship... that break. It's an exciting series, I must admit. I think there's a lot of drama. There's, you know, the new people do bring it as well. I think the new cast members have really got their own, and you know, there's some new sassy characters that will come in to play as well. So it's going to be really fun and exciting.
Talk to me about the new cast. Are they deeply involved and invested as you guys are?
I don't know. I would have to speak to them.
Michael Payne and Marcel Somerville on FUBAR Radio.
We've got Royce the 5'9" on the line. How's it going, sir?
Hello, mate.
Yes, I am here.
Well, you are here. You are indeed here. Yeah, very well, thank you. You are over here as part of Prime, one of your many kind of projects, I think 2-3 years ago now?
That was the Prime Tour.
Yeah,
exactly.
The kind of collaboration with DJ Premier, is that as long a time in the making as we think? Because obviously Boom came out in what, like 2002?
Spent a lot of years just kind of building a relationship.
Yeah.
We did like a lot of work with each other. He worked on various projects of mine. He pretty much did something on every project that I released.
Yeah, of course.
He executive produced one album. He did like a beat or two on each album. By the time we had done like a lot of work together on albums, there was an idea that came to the table for Slaughterhouse to pick one producer that was really good at chopping samples and then find one music source to pull from.
Mm.
When I took the idea to the guys, they weren't really that into the idea, so I felt like it was too good of an idea for me to just kind of waste. Mm-hmm. So I took it to Premier to see how he felt about it. And luckily, you know, I caught him at the right time when he was open to the idea, you know, so we went in and did it, and the rest is history.
Absolutely. Wow. We're all huge fans, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I definitely appreciate that. That's a plus.
So the partnership with J. Cole on Boblo Boat, which is the current single.
Yeah, I was going to give you a little background on how the J. Cole feature happened.
That's like exactly what I was going to ask. You read my mind.
We were talking about getting together and doing some music for like a long time. We sent a couple ideas back and forth to each other, and it was just kind of like, nah, this isn't quite it. You know, this is good, but this isn't quite it, because we got like a mutual respect for one another. And we knew that whatever the first thing that we did with each other, we wanted it to be special. You know, yeah. We wanted to give the people something special. So, he came to Detroit on his tour. He came to my studio. Something about the creative process, man, when you're sitting in a room with the person, it's way easier to connect when you got like-minded personality.
Mm.
Cole is like really cool. He's like a really cool, down-to-earth, smart guy. You know what I mean? Like, kind of like myself, you know? So we sat in the room with each other, man, and everything just fell into place. You know what I mean? Like, I pulled up the beat. I told him the idea. Once we got in the room with each other, that's when everything kind of fell into place. You know what I mean? Because our personalities just matched and everything just came together real organic.
Yo, yeah, right. So J. Cole's obviously, like, he's a big one of my favourite artists at the moment in terms of current artists. He's got a lot of substance, yeah? A lot of people have got a lot of opinions on the state of rap in America right now. Like, obviously, J. Cole's an artist that's got substance. Like, what's your opinion on some of, like, the trap rappers and these, like, people call it mumble rap and this, that, and the other? Like, this is what I'm saying. Even over here, split. Because either I'm a big fan of old-school hip-hop with substance, and I like J. Cole, I like Badass, I like Action Bronson, guys that have got a lot of content and substance. But at the same time, I've got a guilty pleasure.
I like
the ignorant shit as well. I'm not going to lie. Like, it vibes is me, innit? Like, what's your opinion on the state of rap right now?
Really like a lot of the new stuff. I don't like all of it, but I think one thing that's real cool about the climate, man, is like nobody really has to listen to anything that they don't want to listen to.
True,
they don't
straight.
Like it. And nothing's really being forced on you anymore. Everything is on demand. Straight, you know what I mean? Man. So I just kind of live within the realm of what I like. You know, I just kind of live my life based off of what I choose to see, what I choose to listen to. So a lot of the stuff that I don't like, because there's never really been an era in music that there was something where I liked everything. Like,
yeah,
I've always had something that I disliked. You know, so it's the same with this era. I don't think the bad music of this era is any different from the bad music from any other era.
I agree with that.
You know, so the difference to now is I just don't pay it any attention. If I don't like it, it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah, you are definitely revered as an MC's MC. You know, you're a real, real lyricist. Would there ever be a kind of possibility, do you think, of doing a tune with one of these very current kind of mumble rappers?
You know what? I don't really think about it that much, but I'm certainly open to anything creative. I'm certainly up for the challenge. You know, like, if it's somebody that I feel is talented. But
yeah,
the main thing with that, man, is sometimes you can listen to somebody. They may not be a lyricist, but you can hear where they're talented.
Yeah,
you can hear where they're good at what they do.
Appreciate
absolutely.
It.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Royce, just a quick one. What do you think on Kanye's Poop That He Scooped verse?
bro. I mean, I just.
I mean, I ain't gonna lie, I like it.
Man, you listen, man. It's getting a little bit ridiculous, man.
I was genuinely trying to avoid the K word all show.
Right.
He's Voldemort.
I think Hove is the only one who can fix this, man.
Honestly, it all started when Hove stopped talking to him as well. Yeah. He just spiraled out of control, man.
He does need help, though. I took the piss on Twitter earlier and I felt bad.
One minute we're told he has got a mental illness, but then we're told by so-called professionals that that it's harmful saying he's got a mental illness. So that's why I don't talk about it anymore, because I just don't know what the fuck's going on, and I kind of stopped caring, to be fair.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie to you. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, sir.
Thank you so much for all your continued support. Thank you guys, for supporting me. Thank you for having me on the show.
Peace and
love, bro.
Nice.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're joined in the studio now by John Niven, who is an author and a screenwriter.
And me and Nick come from a sort of stand-up background. So would you...
Well, I'm a stand-up.
Stand-up background.
11 a year off. But, and you're a stand-up.
Yeah, yeah.
Stand-up background.
Nick used to be a stand-up.
I used to be a stand-up. Yeah, fucking, right.
But do you have, when you're doing like a book reading, do you have a certain section? Is there a bit of it where you think about that as a bit of performance as well, right?
A little bit. There's a chunk from by Kill Your Friends, the novel that this one's a sequel to. There's quite a long chunk in that book about how young indie bands generally get treated when they get signed to major labels, and I could do that whole 3-page bit verbatim after.
Oh, well.
So you'd find a young, you'd say to the audience, anybody here who's in a band, you get some 19-year-old kid to put his hand up, and you'd do the whole bit sort of to him in the style of the character. Unlike you guys, most novelists aren't sort of natural stand-ups. It's kind of being a writer, you spend a lot of your time alone. And then to have to go out and promote it and get up on a stage in front of people, it's not the natural habitat for a lot of us, which is why you'll use like guest interviewers. It helps. But I guess I've been doing this 10 years now. For instance, I've got two or three chunks now that I know I can do.
Yeah.
So I remember I did Catelyn Moran early on, her published writing career. I might have asked her 10 questions over an hour. Then I did her a few years later when she'd been touring a lot, and I might have asked her 2 questions and she could go for, like, you know, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Stephen King famously said that writing a novel is like crossing the Atlantic in a bathtub. It's a long, quite lonely haul. It's just you for a very long time.
Yeah.
So when the book comes out and you get to, you know, come and meet guys like you and do things like this and all that, it's the funner aspect of it.
Yeah.
But then again, after a couple of weeks of this, you think, oh, God, I just want to get back to my study and write the next book. You know?
Yeah, I don't think it's that far away from stand-up.
No, I don't. Especially doing that kind of performance thing. And I guess you've got all those book festivals now, and you've got Hay on Wye and all that kind of stuff. And like places like Latitude have like a literature tent.
Latitude's a good one to do. I've done all these that you're talking about. It's getting better in this country, but I think for a while it was a bit fusty, and like, as I say, you do it in the afternoon in a bookshop and they wouldn't charge for it, they just like, say come along.
Yeah.
I think when somebody's free with that, it kind of gets devalued.
Yes.
But then I'm lucky, I do quite well in Germany, me and David Hasselhoff. But you go there and they treat it as a, to go and see an English author, they treat it as like an evening's entertainment, and they'll pay like 15-20 euro ticket, and the bigger German cities I enjoy get 200-300 people in like the bigger towns. So you notice that it's been like that in Germany for a while, so hopefully it's starting to improve a wee bit here and there, I think.
And here's a thing, it's vulgar to talk about, but when you've got people paying for tickets, where's that money going? That feels like it's very much part of like the publishing industry. Also feels like, where's all that going?
Well, the one they do now is that you buy, and I had some readers sort of complaining a wee bit on Twitter because the tickets are quite expensive for the tour, like 20 quid. But that includes the hardback, which is like, you know,
oh, yeah, 16, sure. 16, 16,
they're
like,
only paying a few quid to actually hear my drivel. The bulk of the ticket price is going for the book.
Selling the book, which is the point of the book tour.
Exactly.
I remember about 20 years ago now, just going into the Waterstones to have a look around. And it was obviously at a time that Mad Frankie Fraser, the gangster, was doing a signing in Waterstones. But it was obviously like poorly publicised or something. So you'd be walking around, but there'd just be a table in the middle of Waterstones that Mad Frankie Fraser, on his own, looking furious, and like he was about to like tear someone's throat out, just sat by himself, tapping his pen on the table, that you're almost going, and you felt a threat that, I feel like I've got to buy his book. I don't really want to. But he sat there it was just sort of this surreal thing of seeing this guy that you've seen on documentaries about like,
so I took him out and I got his throat,
kind of thing. It's that sort of, and he going, it's, and it was, it just felt so weird that he'd be in that environment as well. Yeah, I'm just sat in a bookshop and no one's coming to get Mad Frankie Fraser's autograph.
You'd have thought Mad Frankie could have intimidated people exactly. into buying his book. He'd be doing
it almost worked.
And there was the, Steve Coogan did the, he did the book tour for, Nomad. He did the Alan Partridge book Nomad, and as a publicity stunt outside, I think it was either going to be London, Manchester or Norwich, but outside the Waterstones in one of those places, he parked the cock piss Partridge car out the front without permission, and then it just got loads of parking fines away. Because he's just like, he can pay it. Yeah. And he was just like this thing, everyone was taking photos of it saying he's there in Waterstones.
That's all the publicity you need, isn't it?
It's amazing. He just parked it illegally out the front, and it had cock piss Partridge, but with the amendments on it, and yeah, just thought that is absolutely fucking incredible. I thought,
yeah, I've got to get a car like that. Watch that into the plot of the next book.
Harriet Rose on FUBAR Radio.
Fraser's in the building.
Yes, I am.
How you doing, babe?
I'm good, you know. How are you?
I'm really well.
Good, good. That's what I like.
Fraser, a.k.a. Richard.
Yes.
A.k.a. Fraser.
That's the government name, isn't it?
What would you rather be called?
Fraser. My mum calls me Fraser. Depends on who's around.
Yeah, but if you're in trouble, does she call you Fraser?
No, the government name goes, Richard!
Yeah. Everything's been pretty mad for you the whole time you've been in the music industry.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely has been. It's been a good run. It's been a good run, and I've learned a lot.
A ride, you could say.
Yeah, and wide, yeah, definitely, man. But it's been a long and wide run, yeah, definitely.
But is it kind of nice sometimes to take a step back and do production, not just... And then when you do come back with a track,
you've got
that energy to kind of...
Of course, man. Like, people might ask what phase I've been up to for the last few years and stuff, and I started up a production company. We've been working with... Mate, we worked with everybody. We've got production credits with everybody. And, it just got to the point after that, and I was like, okay, the production company's flying, it's doing what it's doing, it's moving, it's time to focus on Fraser. So I closed the doors to outside production for the last 8-9 months and really come up with a body of work that is absolutely insane.
You've been having a bit of me time.
Yeah, a bit of me time, just devising a sound for myself, which is similar to what's out now, but it's my own fusion, it's my own twist on it. Do you know what I mean? I got a lot of time for talented people, so my whole camp right now is just full of creatives and the talented people. Swan Sounds is one of them. He's a 19-year-old producer and writer. He's the next up as well. Do you know what I mean?
He's a sweet. He came in the studio last week and we had a lovely time.
I saw.
He was really nice.
He is. He's a good guy, man. He's a really nice guy. Good-hearted person, man. I got time for that.
Yeah, I think as well, in terms of, like, your experience in the music industry, don't you find that people like him, i.e. people who can produce and write their own shit?
You know what it is? It's just like me. So I've got time for talent in general. So if someone's like me and really, like, when I mean like me, the guy lives in the studio, I live in the studio, I don't leave the place. I write and produce all my own music. If someone's like that, like, and has that sort of work ethic behind them and really want to take their careers to a certain height and really believe in themselves and have that drive, then I've got time for that, man.
Is it weird having other people come into your bedroom then? When people come work with you in the studio? Is it a bit like, what are you doing in my bedroom?
Nah, because I don't work from home, man. I have a studio set up upstairs in my house, but that's just for, like, personal stuff. If I need to run a line or I need to make an edit or something, I can just do my stuff there.
So you don't have anyone in there?
Nah, but I've got a main place up in London and in Hertfordshire, which I do most of my work from, and if I'm doing outside sessions, they'll come there. So I don't feel like you're in my house, because my dog won't take to you too well.
Oh, really?
I got a big boy.
Oh, what's
proper,
his name?
A proper dog, King Kainos.
King Kainos, I like the name.
He's a
it's
beast.
Got power.
He's a beast.
Is
Trust
he?
Me, he needed a name like that to suit him, otherwise. So you couldn't call him Fluffy, mate, I'm telling you.
Does he walk you, or do you walk him?
Listen, if I didn't have it, he's got these, like, reins, like what you put on a horse. If I didn't have those on him, yeah, he'll be taking me for a walk.
Do you ride him?
My little daughter does,
yeah. I was going to say. Actually, on that note, now you've got a child, how has things changed for you? Because obviously, when you started in the music industry, you didn't have a child, and now you do.
Nah.
Has that changed your perception of women in the music industry and how kind of that works? Because now you've got a daughter.
It's made me become some paranoid, protective freak, bro. I swear down. It's like,
if I had the money right now, I'd buy an island. And I'd move her to that island and say, you're here living there for good. Yeah, it's changed my outlook in life, as in how I used to be as a person, like where I was just living for myself, just a bit reckless, going out just all night on a mad one and this and that, mm-hmm. where it's kind of like just pulled man back down to earth a little bit, kind of like said, okay, it's not just about you, Faizer, you got other people right now that are depending on you and stuff like that. And it's kind of just giving me a different drive and a different outlook to life, where it's just about Faizer before, in a sense.
Well, I guess as well, in terms of like, because I think when you have a child, I haven't had any children, so I'm just guessing now, okay. But if you're in, like, you've worked with women in the music industry, obviously, yeah. Talisa was in N-Dubs, yeah, you know, yeah, yeah. You know how women can be treated, yep. and things like that, so you've known that from day dot. Yeah. But now you've got... Do you think you'd be happy if your daughter was like, I'm going to be in a band, I'm going to start making music?
Listen, whatever she chooses to do, whatever she wants to put her energy in and her focus on, I'm going to push. So it doesn't really matter if she wanted to do music or not. Like, if she wanted to do music, I'll push her in it. If she wanted to be a ballet dancer, I'll push her in it. It doesn't matter what it is.
Just going to protect her against everyone.
Yeah, so I'm just like, I'm that guy. I'm just like that diabolical dad. It's just going to be weird and just like embarrass the kids. And when they come around with their boyfriends, I just... probably trying to make the boyfriend not want to be on her, type of thing.
Like, yeah, that
know.
Sounds like
you don't, you don't. You don't want to know about her, man. She's a little poo bum over there.
Yeah,
like. It's embarrassing. Like, Dad, what are you doing that for? Like,
that's definitely the best vibe to go on, though. Just embarrass her, say words like poo and fart, and you should get him out of there.
Yeah, it's like, oh, what? You actually do that stuff? Like, what?
You know, the other day I wanted to talk about this because you were talking about meditation.
Yeah. Okay. Go on.
And No. I just meant I've recently found like. I'm not very good at it, and all I do is sit and think about, like, ham sandwiches. But
oh, really?
I found, like, in terms of being in the music industry, it really helps to kind of take 5 minutes and sit. Like,
listen, yeah, this industry is turmoil. It's absolutely crazy. It's moving so fast, yeah. There's so much information to take in at any given moment. Like, when do you actually take a time for yourself and your own peace of mind and your own brain to just slow your thoughts down and actually be able to fathom each individual thought from... one another.
Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas!
You're listening to Christmas Hamper on FUBAR Radio.